In the last 50 years, horror movies have changed a lot. In the last 50 years, everything has changed a lot, with the sole exception of women's hair, makeup, and fashion, which keep looping back to the middle 1960s like a satellite in an elliptical orbit around a very groovy planet. But horror in particular has gone through a lot of changes in 50 years. We've gone from Amicus's Torture Garden to torture porn. We've gone from Christopher Lee being Dracula to much more dangerous vampires like the Coke brothers. From Kensington Gore to CGI blood, and from Robert Block to Rob Zombie. So, speaking of Dracula and other bloodsuckers of the non-oligarchical type, brings me to the next episode of Martian Driving Podcast. I'm going to go back to the age of muscle cars, macrame bikinis, and horrible events in Hollywood mansions to look at a couple of American International Pictures vampire movies. Count Yorga Vampire, 1970, starring Robert Quarry, the poor man's Vincent Price, and Blackula, 1971, starring William Marshall and Vanetta McGee. So it's black and white aristocratic 1970s bloodsuckers, Count Yorga versus Blackula. Welcome to Martian Drive-In Podcast 54. The Martian Drive-In Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of science fiction, horror, and fantasy movie appreciation. It doesn't matter what it is. It could be all the way from George Méliès through to Michael Bay, though I'm not likely to do Michael Bay. But feedback is important to me. So if you want to leave some feedback, you can leave it at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, at gmail.com. You can leave it at the Martian Drive-In Podcast website, marsdrivein.blogspot.com. The other thing you can do is go over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. So if you type in Paleo-Cinema Cafe into Facebook, you can go and leave some feedback there as well. Now, there are occasionally adult concepts in this podcast, so just keep that in mind as you listen, and sit back and enjoy the rest of the show. Hi, how's everybody going? It's Terry here, and it's hot, it's humid, and it's a late-breaking summer for us here in Melbourne. Yesterday we had rain early in the morning and storms and things like that. I know that people up in the northern hemisphere are suffering through snowstorms and all sorts of weird things and like arse-deep frozen water all over the place and all that kind of stuff that you get when you live on a continent attached to one of the poles of the planet. But for us here, it's hot and it's humid and not too bad for that. Now, the reason I'm mentioning it all, the weather, which I do a lot in the podcast, I'll admit, is that I've got the air conditioning going and I get a bit of a hum and a buzz in the background of the audio when I record while the air conditioning is going. I could turn it off for the couple of hours it takes me to record, but then I would probably melt. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to do some cleaning up of the audio afterwards, which may flatten out the sound just a little bit. So if the sound quality doesn't sound as dulcet as it usually is, I apologize for that, but blame global warming. So anyway, I'm doing this on my new all-in-one computer. It's one of those ones where the hard drive and all of the motherboards and that are attached to the back of the screen. It's got a DVD drive sticking out the back. And we picked it up recently. And I like it. I like having an all-in-one computer. It takes up less of the desk space, which I appreciate because I usually have a ton of shit on my desk. I mean, I've got a phone, I've got a desk lamp, I've got a coffee cup full of pens, I've got an autobiography of Federico Fellini, which I've got there for the next Paleo Cinema podcast. I've got a stack of CDs. I've got a stack of photographs I haven't sorted yet. I've got a book that somebody gave me. I've got a couple of DVDs. I've got a bottle of water to have a sip of. I've got a lava lamp. And I've got a USB keyboard. There's a ton of shit on this desk. So the smaller the real estate that gets taken up by the actual computer itself and the stuff that I need to do is of great advantage to me. And, oh, geez, I'm sorry, I'm looking at some of those old photos. And shit, I used to be good looking. What happened? Anyway, on to the podcast. Now, we're doing two vampire movies. I was originally going to do Count Yorga Vampire and The Return of Count Yorga as a double one. And I actually mentioned that in this various social media that I was going to do that. But I'm not. I'm going to go toe-to-toe, head-to-head, Count Yorga versus Blackula, because I think they've taken a couple of different approaches to very similar stories in some ways.
And I like what was done with one of them. The other one, more challenging, but has a much more interesting backstory in some ways. As usual, the next part of the show is me talking about the things I have watched cinematically since the last time we had a chat. Now, I'm just going to bring up the wonderful Letterboxd to see what I've been watching. I know what I've been watching, but it's always good to double check these things because I actually tried to do it off the top of my head once and missed out a couple of really interesting films that I wanted to briefly touch on. Let's see, since the last time I saw John Wick, which is an action film directed by a couple of special effects kind of slash stunt guys, starring Keanu Reeves, and it's probably arguably one of the best things Keanu Reeves has done since maybe The Matrix. He plays a retired hitman whose wife's just died of cancer, and his wife posthumously has given him a puppy as a pet for him to kind of stay engaged with the world. She knows that he's likely to be adrift, and so she buys him a puppy. Now, John Wick drives a very flash vintage sports car, and the son of a Russian mafia boss tries to buy it off him unsuccessfully and then steals it from him and kills his puppy. What they don't know is that John Wick is a hitman of supernatural ability. And so in order to avenge his puppy and to get his car back, he goes totally nuclear on the Russian mafia. Now, dead simple story. A little bit derivative in some ways. It's got touches of The Samurai. It's got touches of The Red Circle and a few other bits and pieces in it. But it's a good, honest action film. It doesn't pretend to be anything it's not. It was filmed in New York City, which always gives you beautiful locations. And really like it. I think it's, if you're into action films and you're in the mood to just sit down with a beer and something munchable and watch an action film, that's definitely one to go for. The people have been very bipolar about it. Some people love it, some people hate it, but I'm kind of in the camp of enjoying it a lot. I did see one of the DC animation movies recently, Throne of Atlantis, which centrally features Aquaman. And I think it's pretty good. I think that it's maybe not as good as the Flashpoint Paradox or something like that. It includes all the New 52 stuff, so it's based in the New 52 universe. But I don't think it's quite as good as things like the Flashpoint Paradox. Nonetheless, it's still watchable. Now, I did have a touch of insomnia during the week, to which I'm prone, particularly when I drink too much coffee. And I grabbed something off the Foxtel HD box, which I had recorded a while back. And it's a French action film from a few years ago called Special Forces, which has Diane Kruger in it. It's basically, she plays a journalist embedded with the troops in Afghanistan. Well, not embedded, but she's in Afghanistan investigating human rights issues, who gets kidnapped by the Taliban, and a French special forces team gets sent in to rescue her. Now, this film isn't like top grade stuff, but it's an interesting piece because it comes from doesn't come from an Anglophone viewpoint. It doesn't come from the viewpoint of America or England or Australia. And it does have a couple of nice set-piece action sequences in it. It's got some very nice helicopter shots and some great location shooting. And, yeah, it wasn't a waste of time. I did enjoy it. It had some interesting actors in it. People like Checky Cario turns out as a military guy. But, you might want to check that out if you get a chance. Now, for the radio gig, with Liz Travascus, who's been back from being sick, we decided we were going to do a comedy. So I thought, I'll get a comedy that stretches us both a little bit to watch. And so we watched Chris Morris's Jihad parody. It's called a Jihad parody. Four Lions, which is about four wannabe suicide bombers in Sheffield in the north of England who basically fuck up everything they touch. They're totally inept. They're borderline moronic, and the movie is very, very funny. Both of us enjoyed it, but I watched it with Sal, actually, and Sal said, I shouldn't be laughing at this bit. And, yeah, it's one of those things where they're doing horrible things, which, from our cultural viewpoint, are incredibly transgressive. And yet Chris Morris had the guts in 2010 to go out and make this film and to make a comedy satirizing the Taliban and satirizing suicide bombers. Actually, no, I think it's about 2004. I forget exactly when it was made, but it was well after 9/11. And I enjoyed it a lot. I think it's a good, honest comedy, and I like transgressive comedies. I like comedies that make me slightly discomforted, and this one did, but not necessarily in a bad way. Then I saw something that I picked up on DVD. I had to go onto eBay to find it because it hasn't had an Australian DVD release. And it's a documentary about a very specific niche genre in 1970s filmmaking, and that is Eurocrime is the name of the movie. It's just basically an overview of hundreds and hundreds of Eurocrime movies, you know, Italian police dramas that were made in the 1970s. It interviews people like Henry Silva and Richard Harrison and John Saxon and a bunch of other people who were involved in that genre, and just shows the kind of cowboy filmmaking that went on to make all of these movies. And they also give a bit of cultural background on it. The reason why there were so many spaghetti westerns made and so many Euro spy movies and so many Euro crime movies was, in Italy, they only had two TV channels, which very rarely showed films. So people were going out to the movies in the 60s and 70s in Italy four times a week. It was fairly cheap to do, so they'd go out and see movies. And so there was this constant hunger for new product. And from that came those Italian micro genres, including Eurocrime. I haven't quite finished watching Eurocrime yet. I got involved with watching the movies for this podcast, but I'm going to go back and maybe rewatch it from the start again to get the whole flow of it. And it's definitely recommended. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema podcast people and Silver and Gold Mob have recommended it, and I recommend it as well. Apart from the two movies I'm watching today, that's about it for what I've been watching. I've got myself on an Xbox embargo at the moment. I'm not playing the Xbox because I've found, as I've stated before, that the Xbox sucks up so much of my movie watching time. I get to the stage where all I'm watching pretty much are the movies for the radio gig with ABC Local Radio in Darwin and for the podcast. And I've got to do more than that. I don't want this to become a chore. And if I don't give myself enough space to just randomly watch a film now and then, there's the risk of this becoming a chore. And I never, ever want that to happen. But moving along from there, let's talk about vampire movies in the 1970s. Now, I've been trying to find a link apart from, like, the time that they were made in between these two films, and I've done a little bit of in-depth research about it. And here's the link, and it's a slightly unusual one. I'm not going to overplay it very much, but both Robert Quarry and William Marshall were minority actors whose careers didn't go as far as they might have had they not been members of the minorities to which they were members. In Robert Quarry's case, it was homosexuality. He was an out gay man at a time when that could have a negative impact on someone's career. And with William Marshall, it was because he was a man of colour. And he never got some of the acting roles that might have really taken his career to that extra level. So I'll just put that out there, leave it from there, no more mention of it will be made. But that's the common thread that I found between the two, and they're quite interesting because of that as well. So first off, we're going to talk about Count Yorga Vampire from 1970. This movie was really big when I was young in Australia. It was a vampire movie that did do a lot of business here in Australia. It did the drive-in circuit. It did the cheap cinemas, which were the ones I was attending at the time, and I did see it at a cheap cinema. I don't remember which one, but I do recall seeing both this and the sequel, The Return of Count Yorga, as a back-to-back pair in the early 1970s in the cinema. Now, I'll play the trailer from that and then talk a little bit about why it's interesting, why it had a very interesting genesis as well.
There are mysteries in the world of which we know little. Strange, frightening, whispered from generation to generation until they become a scream out of the past. A woman of flesh becomes a mistress of the Death Master, sharing his hunger for souls, his thirst for human blood.
Enjoyed your little joke last night, Doctor. But as you can see, tonight is mine.
Incredible, yeah. You really are a vampire.
Yes.
The flesh that shapes them, the blood that feeds them, once belonged to others. Driven by the forbidden cravings of another world, they band together as his slaves. It happened to them. It could happen to you.
Okay, so Count Yorga Vampires, a 1970 vampire movie. It was made for about $65,000 in and around Los Angeles. It's directed by a guy who didn't direct a lot of things. His name was Bob Kilgen. And it was produced by Michael McCready, the son of actor George McCready, who people best remember, probably, if you're a classic film buff, for him being the third corner of the love triangle in the movie Gilda with Glenn Ford and Rita Hayworth. So George McCready actually appears in the second Count Yorga movie, The Return of Count Yorga, but the voiceover you hear at the start with the creepy narration at the start of Count Yorga Vampire is actually the voice of George McCready, who obviously was supporting his son's endeavor. Now, according to Robert Quarry, the actor who plays Count Yorga, a lot of the time there were about four or five people in the crew for the movie. It was a very, very small crew. And they spent a lot of their time smoking dope and drinking wine. So if the movie does suffer because of that, it's not really surprising. It's a very low-budget movie. Quarry himself only got $1,200 for doing the film. But his career was kind of at a low ebb at the time. He started out, he played the boyfriend of Teresa Wright's character in Shadow of a Doubt, the Hitchcock movie. And his role was almost entirely cut out. And he'd done a number of other things. But, of course, there's always that glass ceiling for actors who are homosexual. And studios are very kind of wary and leery of that. He wasn't a fantastic actor, you know, by any means. But he was a good jobbing actor. And I think in Count Yorga and The Return of Count Yorga, he does the kind of Transylvanian aristocrat thing in a good way. He's got a lot of gravitas. He knows how to hold the attention of an audience. And he's got the kind of slightly fading good looks that we usually associate with aristocratic vampires. The story is fairly simple. A couple of couples, Michael and Donna and Paul and Erica, become involved with Count Yorga after a seance in Los Angeles. Count Yorga is trying to, he says, get in touch with the mother of one of the characters, Donna, who mother has just died. So he does a seance, which isn't particularly successful. And a couple of the people involved, Michael Murphy's in the movie as well. He plays Paul, and Michael McCready, the producer, plays Mike. So they're kind of taking the piss out of the seance, as you do. But nonetheless, Count Yorga does take things very seriously, and he is a very charismatic kind of character. And as the story progresses, we learn, of course, that he is a vampire. We also learn that he's got a telepathic ability to ensorcel women. So he, when he's having quiet little conversations with some of the female characters, he's also sending them telepathic suggestions to meet him later. He's kind of like, a vampire, the vampire as a stalker and the vampire as a sexual predator in a way. And even though there's not a lot of kind of spark between Robert Quarry as an actor and the female actors in the movie, he does put across that kind of charisma that's required for this kind of role. Now, the movie was originally going to be a softcore porn film, which is why a number of the female actors were cast for it, particularly Marcia Jordan, who plays Donna's mother, who's one of the brides of Count Yorga, in a sense. And there were a couple of implications. There were several versions of this film. There was one that was cut 6 times so that they could get the GP rating that would enable them to play a lot more drive-in theatres than they could otherwise. And that's the version that I saw originally, and it's the widely sent out version. But there is a newer version called The Loves of Count Yorga, spelled with an I rather than a Y, which has some of the footage removed, replaced in the film. And it does include some scenes that give the movie a little more complexity and a little less kind of generic feel about it. There's one scene where one of the women who Count Yorga has hypnotized, in a sense, is found by her friends chewing on a kitten, basically eating and sucking the blood out of a kitten. And in the original cut of that film, that scene is almost subliminally fast. But in the version that I saw yesterday, you can see that she's holding the kitten there and she dips down and starts eating and drinking from it. That was actually done in an interesting way. Not necessarily the kindest way to the kitten, but the kitten did live and it wasn't really harmed by it. So what they did was they sedated a kitten and they put canned lasagna on it so that the actor involved, I think it was Judy Lang, her name is, could then kind of dip down and pretend to eat the entrails and suck the blood out of this poor little knocked out kitten. But it is a very kind of transgressive scene, a little surprisingly so for a 1970 movie. But, I mean, there's a whole bunch of very kind of cool and groovy 1970s things in this. For instance, the Michael Murphy character, and Michael Murphy's an actor you might remember from any number of things. If you look through his IMDb, you'll see them there. He did the Tanner 88 stuff with Robert Altman, for instance, and was in Phase 4, another movie that I've talked about on the Martian Drive-In podcast. But Michael Murphy drives a brand new red combi van, which these days would be worth tens of thousands of dollars. But it's really groovy to see a kind of combi van in a movie that's not beaten up old wreck or a kind of hippie truck. This one's just like a stock standard mattress in the back combi van. And it's nice to see that as well. And the movie is a little bit dialogue heavy as well. There's a lot of kind of speculation and talking around things. For instance, there's the combi van gets bogged down in a kind of mud swamp, a small stack, a lot of mud in the road that wasn't there not long ago. So there's the kind of built-up implication that Count Yorga can control a lot of things. He can control the land. He can control people's minds. He's much smarter, he says, than human beings are, being the apex predator, obviously. And I think that Robert Quarry does put this stuff across very well. There's another character in there, a doctor, a hematologist called Dr. Jim Hayes, played by Roger Perry, who people best remember from a couple of episodes, an episode of original Star Trek that he did. Again, a lot of these people, Michael Murphy was right at the start of his career. It was one of his first roles, in fact. But people like Roger Perry and Robert Quarry were kind of those jobbing actors that get tiny little roles or maybe one-off pieces in a TV show for one episode, who are kind of in that level of the eco chain of Hollywood acting in the 1960s, where they could pretty much put their hand to anything, but weren't really getting those breakthrough roles for whatever reasons, whether it's a reason of personality, whether it's a reason of talent or just bad luck. A lot of these actors really didn't get the breaks that they, I wouldn't say that they desired, kind of. But the movie, for a $65,000 budget, does well. It builds an atmosphere nicely. It really does. It's one of the first movies that brings vampires into the 20th century, now into contemporary times. Now, there were one or two others that had as well, but this is the first really acknowledged one that brought vampires into contemporary times and tried to make it a part of contemporary mythology in that sense. And that's one of the problems with doing that kind of thing as well, because, you know, somebody starts getting anemic and they've got marks on their necks, immediately you think vampire these days. We're so attuned because of pop culture to that sort of thing that if there were vampires around, it'd be fucking hard for them to really stay unidentified for any length of time, because we know all the mythology. We know the stuff about inviting them into houses. We know the stuff about them not appearing in mirrors or photographs. We know everything about crucifixes and wooden stakes and them needing to go back to their graves or their coffins, at least, before daylight, all that kind of stuff. We're pretty hip to. And vampires would have a rough trot, even in 1970s. And there's a lot of talk around the growing realization among the characters in this film that they are dealing with a vampire. Now, there is a twist ending as well, which is to 21st century cinema viewers, not that much of a twist. We know what's going to happen there. It's something that happened a few years before in The Fearless Vampire Killers as well. So even in 1970, it wasn't a particularly new kind of trope to throw in there. But again, we're talking about kind of bottom-feeding filmmakers here. Nobody involved in this film really went on to have a fantastic career, with the exception of Michael Murphy. And this is, as I said, an early role of his. They're kind of, you know, you're kind of journeyman, everyday jobbing actors who did what they needed to do to survive. They had a reasonable agent. Some of them tried to, maybe had studio contracts early in their careers and were dropped by the studios and then had to scramble around for acting roles. Some of them did dinner theatre and radio and television and whatever was required for them to obviously earn a living. That's indeed the experience Robert Quarry had. He did Count Yorga and The Return of Count Yorga. He did Death Master as well for AIP and went over to do the second Dr. Fibes films with Vincent Price in England. And apparently Samuel Arkoff was quite homophobic, and when Robert Quarry turned up with his then partner, a guy called Juan, there was a lot of talk about it in London at the time. And one of the things that Samuel Arkoff did was made it known to everybody that Robert Quarry was homosexual and may have put the brakes on the man's career in the 1970s. Now, Robert Quarry was born in 1925, so he wasn't particularly a young man when Count Yorga and The Return of Count Yorga was made. He was about 50 by 1975, so there's the argument that his career may not have taken off very much anyway, because it's a little late in the game for that to be the case. But nonetheless, that kind of stuff doesn't help a career. And though there's not much evidence that Robert Quarry was bitter about it, he kind of was aware and had a kind of knowledge of the business that he was working in and enjoyed his career for what it was, which is not a bad attitude to take. I mean, not everybody has to sit on top of the hill. You can still get a good view and an enjoyable time not being at the top of that hill, but doing something you enjoy and being thankful for the roles that you do get. And I think that from the interviews that were had with him and from people who knew him, he was somebody who had that kind of realistic attitude to his career. And though he would have obviously wished for more of it, was not satisfied but content with the level at which he attained fame. And of course, towards the end of his life, he did a number of Q&As and did a number of the celebrity shows and things like that, and was gratified by the fan base that he had developed over the years. So, yeah, all credit to Robert Quarry. Apparently he was not an unreasonable person, quite a nice guy, but he's just one of those guys who's a combination of the times he lived in, his essential nature, and bad breaks didn't really get to do the things that he would have liked to have done. And again, he has that to a certain extent with William Marshall, the star of Blackula, though William Marshall, I would argue, was an immensely more talented actor. I'll talk about that just after the next break when I talk about Blackula. But just to polish off Count Yorga Vampire, I went to rewatch it yesterday for the podcast and wasn't expecting too much, but in all fairness, I got a lot more than I expected to for a movie that was made with five figures budget, with a limited crew who were partly stoned, and a cast of softcore porn female actors and male actors who were either at the start of their career or just jobbing actors. I think it does kind of well. I think it's very much of its time, and I think that it basically fulfilled the brief it had, which was to be good, honest driving fair and to be something that people can look back with a certain nostalgia and perspective with. What is it? Almost half a century later. So, you know, 40-odd years later. So, The Return of Count Yogra, I haven't completed watching that. I was going to do the second part of this podcast, but then I thought I'd combine it with Blackula. But I'm going to go back and watch The Return of Count Yogra. Some people say it's a better film than Count Yogra Vampire. It had a bigger budget and a few more well-known actors with a little more skill to them. But I'm looking forward to that, and I just want to do that comparison. I may talk about it a bit in the future. But anyway, I'm going to take another break now. And when I get back, we're going to look at a somewhat different movie from a year later, and that is Blackula with Prince Mermawalde, who is trapped by Dracula himself and turns up in modern-day Los Angeles as a black aristocratic vampire.
You shall pay, Black Prince. I curse you with my name. You shall be Blackula.
Blackula. The Black Avenger. Rising from his tomb to fill the night with horror. Blackula, Dracula's soul brother. Deadlier even than he.
You know, he is a strange dude.
You're the nut that ran in front of my cab. You're the only imbecile on this street. Boy.
Blackula.
Look at man, you found on me. He's got to be around here somewhere. I mean, now listen, you take your hands off of me. I don't know you.
He thirsts for your blood. He hungers for your soul. Warm young bodies will feed his hunger. Hot, fresh blood will quench his awful thirst.
Make it a Bloody Mary. Are you into the occult?
No!
How about the heavy stuff?
What do you think of vampires?
Vampires? I think they're possibly the most fascinating of all.
More horrifying than Dracula. The Black Avenger. Blackula. From American International Pictures.
I think there may be another Adolf Caesar voiceover for that particular trailer for Blackula. Yeah, I like this film a lot. I've got the Blackula and Scream, Blackula, Scream on a box set of the two. Second one has the advantage of having Pam Grier in it as Blackula's ostensible love interest. But yeah, this one I've got a great fondness for. And the more I read about it, the more I like it as well. It was directed by a 23-year-old director, which is kind of rare at the time, called William Crane, who'd done an episode of a TV series, The Mod Squad, and did a number of things afterwards. He did another black-related horror film in 1976, Dr. Black, Mr. Hyde, and did a bit of directing on episodic TV like Matt Houston, Dukes of Hazzard, SWAT, The Rookies, and a couple of episodes of Starsky and Hutch. But his career never really took off too much, which is a little bit of a shame, because I think he's got a good television director style about him. The movie's directed very much in that kind of 1970s television directing style, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. It carries the story well. And the story is kind of interesting. William Marshall, the actor playing Blackula, worked with the producers and wanted to really flesh out the character a lot. He wanted to give it a bit more gravitas and a bit of quality. Originally, the character's name, rather than Prince Mermawalde, was going to be something really prosaic. I'm just going to find it here, because he was going to have a really naff kind of name. But fortunately, that didn't happen. And he ended up being called Prince Mermawalde. Here it is. He was going to be called Andrew Brown, which is not really the kind of name you want for an aristocratic vampire, or any vampire at all. Nobody's going to see a movie about a character called Andrew Brown. but William Marshall worked with it. They found the backstory. They put in a bunch of backstories, basically to make the character a little more realistic. And that's nice that he tried to do that as well, because it, essentially it was an AIP exploitation film, and the fact that the lead actor was willing to go to the distance of trying to make it so much better is all credit to William Marshall, who later went on to be a teacher of acting at various places, including the University of California, Irvine, and another acting school up in Watts. So the story is fairly simple. William Marshall, I'm kind of reading and paraphrasing this from Wikipedia. William Marshall plays an 18th century African prince named Mamawalde, who is turned into a vampire and later locked in a coffin by Count Dracula. Two centuries later, the now undead Mamawalde rises from his coffin, attacking various residents of modern Los Angeles. Mamawalde later meets Tina, played by Vanetta McGee, a woman he believes to be the reincarnation of his deceased wife, Luva. So that's basically it. Cast, as I said, is pretty good too. Vanetta McGee, who people will remember was the love interest to Clint Eastwood in The Iga Sanction, and she was also in Shaft in Africa with Richard Roundtree, which I saw fairly recently. Really, she had a great style about it, a very beautiful woman, but a fine actor as well. And she was one of those actors who always had some gravitas and grace about her as well. She really, again, not the person who didn't get the roles that they particularly deserved. She did have a long-term relationship with Max Julian, who people might remember from a blaxploitation movie called The Mac, and then married Carl Lumley, another fine actor who mostly does voiceovers these days, but who I remember from, he played the Black Electroid from Planet 10 in Buckaroo Banzai, for instance. But Vanetta McGee's very good in that, and even though she is playing somebody who's, she plays Luva the wife in the 1780 part of the movie right at the start, but she also plays the modern Tina. And she, even though she is basically there as a love interest, she does bring a lot of class to the role, which is kind of nice too. And Canadian actors in there as well, playing one of the cops, Gordon Pinsent, who people remember for a number of things. He played the president in Colossus the Forbin Project as well. And Canadian listeners may well know him from any number of other things. Still a jobbing actor as far as I can recall. And had a very long career. He kind of had slightly John F. Kennedy good looks, so he ended up playing those kind of roles. But in this one, he's playing a copper. Denise Nicholas is in there. This is her first directing role. And an interesting actor with a slightly difficult to pronounce name, Thalmas Ressalala, playing a police forensic expert, a forensic doctor, who starts investigating these people who are turning up with bite marks on their necks. And Thalmas Ressalala, his original name was Jack Crowder, and he'd done a whole bunch of episodic TV in the early 1960s and up into the 1970s under the name of Jack Crowder, and then went on to call himself a more Africanized name, of course, Thalmas Ressalala, and did a number of cool films. There's one in particular that I want to do for a future Paleo Cinema podcast, which is really a fine movie, probably the best of the work that he did, and that was a movie called Cool Breeze, which I'm going to have to rewatch whether I do it for the podcast or not, because I do like it a lot. But so the ensemble is pretty good there. But then you've got William Marshall as well with that deep resonant voice. Most people remember him most of all, and kind of sadly and slightly ironically, as the King of Cartoons on Pee-wee's Playhouse. So he played the King of Cartoons on there. He also played Dr. Richard Daystrom in an episode of Star Trek, the original series. And he... but did do have a long career on Broadway as well. He did an Othello in the 1950s that was compared favorably with John Gielgud's. And he also played Othello in a jazz musical adaptation of it in the 1960s, in 1968, with Jerry Lewis playing Iago, which would have been a cool thing to see. Indeed, he was one of those actors whose range and skill set was incredibly admired by other actors as well, which is one of the reasons, of course, why he ended up teaching acting as the roles dried up. But in this one, he brings much, much more to Prince Momoalde than he was getting paid for, essentially. There are some really great things. When he first leaves the coffin in the 20th century after having been trapped in there for almost 200 years, there are these little bits of business he does that really do give you an impression that, yeah, he has been trapped in there for nearly 200 years. Just the way he kind of moves his body and stretches his shoulders and blinks and looks around and all that kind of stuff. It's a well-thought-out little piece of acting there. Now, there are downsides to this movie as well, and one of them, of course, is the slightly stereotyped camp interior decorators who find Momoalde's coffin and open it while they're trying to renovate. You know, they bought some bits and pieces for renovations, and part of that is the coffin, and they get attacked by Momoalde, who obviously hasn't fed for 200 years, and one of them's cut his arm somewhat opening a crate. But that's 1970 stuff, but I don't think they really overplay it. They play the camp, but they don't play it dismissively particularly, even though I suppose at the time in the 1970s, audiences may have laughed at the camp interior designers. But these days, it doesn't play incredibly obnoxiously, maybe the way that one of the characters in Vanishing Point is played, for instance. But, yeah, again, it was another time with another idea about people and the range of sexualities, and that kind of tacit homophobia was a part of the scene then, even. But it's only a minor part of the film, and it's not really a part that spoils the movie for me in any way, even though I kind of was aware of it when I was watching it. Now, there's a link between this movie, he said, pausing for effect, and Blue Velvet. And it's not really an obvious one, but there is a direct link between Blackula and Blue Velvet, apart from the first two letters of their names. And that is one of the actors, the female cab driver who ends up telling off Momoalde after she hits him with the cab and then getting bitten by him, is played by Kenny Lester, who sang Love Letters in 1962. Yeah, Love Letters Straight From Your Heart, which again was used to great effect by David Lynch when he made Blue Velvet. So there's a direct link between Blue Velvet and Blackula, Keddie Lester. And she originally started out as a singer, and she had a couple of hits. And if you go to YouTube and type in Keddie Lester, there are some recordings of her singing which are pretty damn good, and some video of her singing that's pretty damn good. But she then went on to try to have a career as an actor. It didn't really pan out for her. But she did get a few roles, and one of them, of course, was as the cab driver in Blackula. So it's kind of cool to notice her name in there as well. The plot of the movie is pretty simple. Prince Momoalde comes back. He meets somebody he believes is the reincarnation of his late wife and pursues her. Meanwhile, not realizing, because he was bitten by Dracula and immediately shoved into a coffin for 180 years, doesn't realize that the people he bites and kills and feeds from become vampires as well. So as Momoalde is kind of, you know, feeding and pursuing Tina, whom he believes is a reincarnation of his wife, suddenly all of his vampire gets are out there terrorizing Los Angeles, rising from morgue slabs. Really great little cameo there as a morgue attendant by Elisha Cook Jr. as well. He plays a morgue attendant with an artificial hand, which is kind of a nice touch as well. And there is the great scene done in slow motion of Keddie Lester running towards Elisha Cook Jr. after she comes off the morgue slab with the kind of her hair all tizzed out and a mouthful of fangs, which is kind of very effective. And the director, William Crane, does a good job with that scene as well. The other thing I didn't mention about William Crane is not only was he 23 years old, but he was, and he is, a man of color. So there's not too many studios in 1972 that would give a movie directing role, direction, to a 23-year-old black man. But they did that with William Crane. I think he does a reasonable job of it as well. The movie won a Best Horror Film at the Saturn Awards at the time, which either goes to show how good the movie is or how fallow the field was. But Blackula is a good, honest thing. Now, there was Vernita McGee once said, McGee once said that she didn't like the term blaxploitation. She didn't mind the black part, but the exploitation part doesn't really take into account the complexity of the movies that were part of that genre. And to be honest with you, even though I like the blaxploitation name just as a term that people know, I do see what she means. And this movie does have some cool stuff in it. It's got some scenes in a nightclub with the Hughes Corporation singing songs in the background. And there is that slight feel of black life in Los Angeles in the 1970s, which was always one of the strong suits of various blaxploitation movies. Even things like Dolomite had, you could see what people wore and how people were in the 1970s in that particular area of America. And there is that kind of sense of community there where they get, Tina and her friends go out to nightclubs and things like that and meet up with a guy called Skillet, played by Jeetu Kambukka, who's always on the hunt for girls and who is particularly smitten with the nightclub photographer who plays a very important role in the ensemble finding out that Prince Mamawalde is a vampire. She takes some photos of the group, and, of course, he doesn't show up in the photos. But I do have to agree with Miss McGee in the fact that there's a lot more to blaxploitation films than the name would suggest. And I really, every time I see a new blaxploitation movie, even if it's really ordinary and the direction's crap and some of the acting's crap, I always find it a really interesting window into the past and window into the kind of movies people liked in the past as well. And blaxploitation movies were quite popular here in Australia, even though we don't have a large black American population, or even a large indigenous population, unfortunately. They were very popular because they were dynamic and cool action films. They were basically for working class Australian kids like myself. They were a lot more fun than just watching soap operas on television, watching Bell Bird at 6:30 on this ABC or anything like that. They were kind of cool stuff for us to watch. And this was pre-computer games as well, so you couldn't really play computer games all day. You had to go out, get off your ass, go outside, put your money through the little window and sit down to watch a movie, which is something that I loved and I still love doing. I mean, going to an old cinema and paying for my ticket and getting a choc-top ice cream and sitting down in old-style theatre seats is still an immensely nostalgic and fulfilling thing for me. And Blackula is a movie that sits right in that sweet spot of my personal history with cinema when I would spend money on movie tickets rather than eat. I'll go, okay, well, I've got this much money left until the next time the unemployment benefits come through. What am I going to do? Right, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to buy 20 packets of Chinese noodles. And this is before people were eating Chinese noodles. I had to go down to Chinatown to get Chinese noodles. So I'd go down to Haymarket in Sydney, buy a great big mesh bag of Chinese noodles and oranges, take them into the cinema with me, watch two or three movies in a row in different cinemas around the CBD of Sydney because they were all single-screen cinemas at that stage, and then take the stuff home and basically live on Chinese noodles and oranges until the next payment came through, and then I'd do the whole thing all over again, which is why I've seen so many of these movies already, because that's the way I lived at the time. Nowadays, you don't have to get off your ass to do that sort of stuff. Now, you just kind of download the stuff and have somebody go online, buy the groceries online, have somebody deliver them. You could sit on a commode and do what I did back in the day, at least as far as the movie watching part's concerned. But hanging out in the city and doing the things I did in Sydney in the 1970s was a cool thing. It was a great time to be alive. You could go on unemployment benefits and educate yourself. And I was reading, five or six books every couple of days to educate myself at the time, apart from watching the movies. I had to travel 30 kilometers to get into the city by train. So I had a lot of time to read books and a lot of time to watch movies. And this is even before VHS tapes, of course. And I kind of miss that to a certain extent. The ubiquity of media now makes it, I mean, I love the fact that I can, if I want to see a movie and I'm willing to be a little transgressive, I can just download a torrent and watch a movie. But I miss the hunt in that sense. I miss the hunt for movies like Blackula and Count Yorga Vampire, where I'd have to plan it out and go, okay, the session's on at this time, and I'm now 35 kilometres away. I can either walk into Liverpool or take a bus into Liverpool. Then I've got to meet it up at the train, and then I've got to get out of the train station and walk across to Sydney CBD and buy my ticket. And I'm going to get thirsty by then, so I probably should buy a drink as well, so I'll get a can of Coke here. And there was a logistical process to going and seeing movies, which I kind of miss. These days it's fairly easy. I get in the car, I drive to a large shopping centre where there's a multiplex, I watch a movie, I come out and go home. There's not the adventure and romance that there was in those days. And just re-watching movies like Count Yorga Vampire and Blackula brings back a lot of that nostalgia for me, even though it did take up inordinate amounts of time. And the longest I think I did was I had to go to the Rose Bay Winter Garden to see the final program, the movie with John Finch in it, the Robert Frost film based on the Michael Moorcock, Jerry Cornelius stories. And the total distance travel would have been 50 kilometres via first bus, then train, then change trains, then another bus to get there and reverse the whole process to get back again. Some of those train trips I took without buying a ticket because I didn't have too much money. But that's the sort of length that I would go to watch a movie. And it could take 2.5 to 3 hours to get from one end to the other. So, it's a non-trivial thing. It's one of these days I'm going to do my rant about pornography with the fact that, you know, what it was like to get pornography in the 1970s compared to what it is in the second decade of the 21st century. Again, it's a hunter-gatherer kind of thing. You had to track it down and take it with you and drag it home and hide it and all that kind of stuff, whereas now you just have to type 5 letters into an address bar and a browser and it's all there for you. I mean, you guys have it so easy. But anyway, just to round things up, Blackula and Count Yorga Vampire, both good, solid 1970s vampire movies, minor films to a great extent. They're not Citizen Kane of vampire movies by any means, but they were there to fulfill a market niche in drive-ins and shabby little hard-top cinemas like the ones I saw them in. And they do show us that it wasn't just Hammer doing these things at the time. There were other studios making vampire movies and making horror films in the USA as well. And it's only now putting it all together that you really see them in a kind of mosaic of horror films, a progression that goes from Lon Chaney to Rob Zombie, for instance. There's a continuum there. And there's a little mosaic part in the middle that says 1970s AIP exploitation vampire movies. And these two films very much fit into that little part of the continuum. But anyway, I'm going to take a break now. I want to get back. Got a little bit of feedback. And then we can wrap this puppy up.
Love letter straight from your heart. Keep us so near while apart. I'm not alone in the night. When I can have all the love you. And I kiss the name that that you sigh. From the start, love letter straight from your heart. I'll memorize every line. And I kiss the name that you sign. And darling, then I'll read again right from the start. Love letters straight from your heart.
That, of course, was Keddie Lester with Love Letters. I did get some feedback from sunny Minnesota from a guy I met in 1998, David Cummer. David says, "Hey, Terry, David Cummer here. I figured it was the time to start throwing in my 2 cents here. Things are quiet here except the house across the street catching fire on Christmas Eve, as you do. The main reason why I'm writing this is to ask if you ever heard of a recent French TV series that returned, Les Revenants. I just picked it up on DVD from my library, and it's really good. There's an American TV program, Resurrection, that's awfully similar, except the French version is based on Stephen King's short story, Sometimes They Come Back, and the movie of the same name. The latter is supposed to be based on James Mott's novel, The Returned. Talk later, eh?" David, I actually borrowed it from the library myself. Before you sent me the email, I went to my library, and we've got the SBS TV version of it, which I haven't watched it yet, but I've got to return it to the library soon, so I better get my ass off and watch the episodes of The Returned. I kind of like French horror movies. I haven't seen too many of them apart from the usual Yeux Sans Visage and a few other things like that, but Sal watched The Returned when it was on cable here, and she's recommended it to me as well. So given the fact that you and Sal have recommended it, I probably should watch it. So I may transcribe, if you know what I mean, the DVDs that I've got of it so that I can watch that series. But thanks for the recommendation, and I'm willing to take recommendations from people. So you can send emails to cultguru@gmail.com, cult with a K, and I'm more than happy to check things out. So that's about it for this time around. I will be back in 2 weeks with another Martian Drive-In podcast. I may have some guests. I'm trying to line up somebody to do Strange Days, the Catherine Bigelow movie, with me. But anyway, in the meantime, look after yourself. Stay warm if you're up north. Stay cool if you're down here. Enjoy good movies and keep watching the skies, and I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. And by the way, right at the end here, you're going to hear the people who have supported the podcast via the Patreon campaign as our end credits. And of course, their names will be read out with their job descriptions in this mythical paleo cinema Martian Drive-In podcast movie. So I'll see you soon. Again, thanks to all of the lovely people who support the podcast through the Patreon campaign. And as usual, in the manner of movie credits, here are their names and their jobs in the mythical Paleo Cinema Martian Drive-In movie. Thank you to Alyssa the Location Scout, Tansy the Foley Artist, Miss Jane the Wardrobe Mistress, Christopher the Gaffer, Chris the Camera Operator, Julia the Casting Director, Elaine, the scientific advisor, Matt, the rattlesnake wrangler, Armin, the key grip, Jan, the dialect coach, Morris, the musical director, Gary, the prop master, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects technician, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, and our newest supporter, Claire, the script doctor. So thank you very much to all of those people. And if you'd like to join them on the credits, go to patreon.com/paleocinema. I'd also like to thank Sally, who is the assistant to Mr. Frost and his muse, and also to Mr. Debussy for playing his music, The Gollywog's Cakewalk. I'll see you all again soon.